needed to postpone the last hearing that was last week. We'll look forward to hearing about our poll book status next week in a hearing. So the first bill on our agenda today is Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1732.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to present Senate File 1732, which is the Help America Vote Act, another acronym, HAVA, funds deadline for voting equipment purchase extension. So joining me at the table to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Officers is Joe Mansky with Ramsey County. And Madam Chair, it is my intention to move Senate File 1732 to pass and be sent to the Rules and Administration Committee. And right now there are no author amendments. And so I'll just briefly go for the next 35 minutes about Senate File 1732. I was seeing if Senator Hayden was listening. So Senate File 1732 is being brought forward by the Minnesota Association of County Officers as they are seeking to extend the current deadlines outlined in state law to purchase voting equipment with the funds that were distributed to counties under the Help America Vote Act. And that the bill would allow counties, it gets two more years before they have to spend any of the HAVA funds that they still have on hand. And right now, Madam Chair, there are currently over 15 counties that still have unspent funds. This bill allows them to wait and see what new technology comes on the market, as well as what new initiatives would come from the state dealing with election administration. Secretary of State's office is supportive of this measure, and they're here to answer any questions as well or concerns. The counties would prefer to save their funds instead of spending them in the next year on equipment that we know will be outdated in a few years. So with limited funds and aging equipment, counties want to make sure that they're making the best decision on what equipment will serve their needs and that they are buying at competitive prices. So here to testify on behalf of MACO is Joe Mansky with Ramsey County.
Mr. Mansky, welcome back to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair, for the tape. I'm Joe Mansky from the Ramsey County Election Office, and here's my one-minute presentation. I think most of you know that most counties bought new voting equipment on the order of 10 years ago because they had this HAVA money. And at the moment, we're at the point where we need to replace this equipment. The problem is there is nothing out there worth buying. New systems are coming, but they are not ready right now. What we'd like to do is just delay the date by which we have to spend the rest of the HAVA funds and allow these new systems to come online. We expect by the end of this year we should have three additional vendors voting systems certified and ready to go. And to be honest with you, Madam Chair, we'd like to let the free enterprise system work in our favor and have a little competition among the vendors and save a little money and get some better service from them.
Mr. Mansky, do you anticipate that there'll be any more HAVA funds coming the state's way?
Madam Chair, not in yours or my lifetime.
Any questions from the committee? With that, Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 1732 be recommended to pass and referred to the Rules Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Senator Sieben, Senate File 1924. If you want to speak to the bill or make your motion?
Begin. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Do I have the right one?
Right. Senate File 1923.
1923.
No, 24. I have my things in different. I'm sorry, you're right. Senate File 1924.
Okay, and that the motion would be to for it to pass and to
refer
and
to send to the rules committee, please. Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this bill came from South St. Paul School District. You'll hear from them shortly. It's a bill that would allow the School District of South St. Paul to conduct their elections on an at-large basis instead of by individual wards or by wards. And perhaps I'll let the testifiers speak to the rationale behind it. But I just think that this makes a lot of sense for the city of South St. Paul, for the School District of South St. Paul. And with that, perhaps we could hear from Superintendent Webb, who is the superintendent of schools, and also Ann Cunahan, who is the on the school board of South St. Paul. They're here to testify.
And Mr. Webb, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Sure. I'm David Webb, South St. Paul superintendent.
Okay, thanks. And to the bill.
Absolutely. So just in a nutshell, we want great board members, just like every school district does in South St. Paul. And just in recent years within the ward system, what we're seeing is it's harder and harder to fill our school board positions. And when a ward position opens up, we oftentimes will have interested candidates, but they might be residing in a different ward area than the seat that becomes available. So if a spot comes open in Ward 1, somebody in Ward 3 might be interested. Just we don't have a long list of candidates vying for positions, and oftentimes our candidates run unopposed. And in most of our recent elections, our candidates have run unopposed. So just in a nutshell, our city currently runs on an at-large system. They've been asking us for years to try to align with their system, and that would save us financially and just align with the Dakota County system as well. And so we're here today just requesting special legislation just to move from the ward system to an at-large system.
Okay. I am Cunahan, South St. Paul School Board. If I could just add a little historical perspective, and Dr. Webb, you and I didn't speak to this ahead of time, but South St. Paul, like many school districts, particularly in the metro area, went through a period of declining enrollment. And in the past, when my father sat as a school board member, we ran on wards to represent individual neighborhood schools. Those schools, elementary schools, have since consolidated into really a north end and a south end school. So the ward system played into that type of a citywide structure, and it no longer plays into that. And in fact, what it does now is limits the amount of people that we can tap to run or ask to run or certainly to hold contested elections. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Cunahan. Any questions at all for Dr. Webb or Ms. Cunahan? And Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, when it's appropriate, I do have an amendment that council recommended. It's the A1 amendment. Okay. If we could please move that.
Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment?
It should be in members' packets. And essentially all it does, it just says that we don't want any special law, any other special laws that are applicable to the district to impact this.
Okay. And this would be the an amendment just to get it in the shape and form that the author would like. So if you'd like to move that amendment, we could just move that now. So Senator Sieben moves the A1 amendment. To get it in the shape and form that she would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is passed. And any questions at all? Yeah. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Sieben, and folks are glad to have you here today and appreciate that, taking your time. Question I have for you, though, is in regards to minorities. Number one, many times in these wards, some of the benefits that courts have seen was the ability for a minority district to have a minority representative. Considering the area of the state that you are, that might be, in fact, in your case. So my concern is that kind of representation, not based upon the elementary schools, but something else. So can you tell me your current minority statistics and how this might impact them and their voting?
Yeah,
we currently
Dr.
have.
Webb.
Go ahead. Sorry. Nope. We currently have a 20% Hispanic student base within our school district. We have about a 5% African American base, and just a much smaller population of other minority populations. And then just an interesting fact within the school board, just being a male member of the board is a minority. We have an all-female school board currently. So.
Okay. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my concern was beyond that, was more to do with your Hispanic. And can you tell me if you have any current Hispanic representation or elected school board and how this changing of this situation might affect them?
No, Dr. Webb. We don't have any particular ward where we're concentrated, where it's a majority of Hispanic base or predominant. We have like ELL instructors, English as a second language instructors, district-wide in our elementaries and also within our secondary site.
And thank you, Senator. If I could Ms. just Cunahan. Please add, certainly that was something that we discussed as a board because that argument of underrepresentation is something that we would take very seriously. Having not had a Hispanic or an African-American member step forward to run, we feel and felt at the time when we were discussing this that the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages in having a board that's representative of the entire community. And I, speaking as one member of seven, I serve on behalf of all of the children of South St. Paul, and I don't represent or underrepresent one member, but I appreciate the question. Thank you.
You said that the city has now been doing this for some time. Has that been for quite a while that they've been doing at-large elections?
Correct.
As long as I can remember.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, Senator Sieben renews her motion to for Senate File 1924 to pass and to be as amended. Be recommended to pass and referred to the full Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed. And Senator Sieben to Senate File 1923.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senate File 1923 is a more broadly written piece of legislation that came about after, quite honestly, after I discussed introducing this bill for South St. Paul. The School Board Association expressed interest in having this be more broadly available to school districts around the state. And I should say that I think that this current version of the draft, there's still some things that we need to work on, and perhaps we can discuss here in committee today. Senator Newman and I were speaking earlier, and he mentioned a concern that I thought was valid, that perhaps, and we had an amendment drafted that would say that before a school district can change to an at-large system, it needs to the question should go before voters. And so that is the A3 amendment, which perhaps we could adopt or talk or discuss at this time first. This is the first stop of this bill, and my only concern is and so perhaps we could discuss this amendment and then get the bill in the shape that it would get the bill in the shape I would like.
Sure, and Senator Sieben, I suppose we could just adopt the amendment now and discuss it, since it is just to get it in the shape and form that you would like. So we can discuss it after the vote as well, if that's amenable. So we'll Senator Sieben moves the A3 amendment to Senate File 1923 to get it in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And Senator Sieben to the bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'll notice, members, that in the A3 amendment, it also indicates that it says a school district located wholly or partly within a city of the first class. And so the idea here that I still think could use some further discussion is that it's partially based on the issue that Senator Kiffmeyer raised, that we don't want to we want to maintain districts where they have wards when it's an especially large school district, or there are different minority populations located within a district, because I just think that's something that we want to maintain. So I'm not quite certain at this point how we get to that, whether this gets us there with cities of the first class, or we need to include more school districts that would not be able to do this. Perhaps we could hear from Ms. Kelleher, and she could help us out with this.
Thank you. And Ms. Kelleher, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I am here today on an issue which has been in front of my legislative agenda for the last 11 years. Not really ever moved because it just wasn't very exciting. But it really is, the law gives us one way to move, and unfortunately, once you get there, you have a problem. I have a list of school districts that this impacts. It would impact Anoka, Hennepin, Cook County, Elk River, Gibbon, Fairfax, Winthrop, Lake of the Woods, Lake Superior, McRae, Norman County West, Red Rock Central, Russell, Tyler, Ruthton, St. Louis County, and Winona. And I just have a short story I want to share with you. There are at least two districts we know who would like to use this law. They are Cook County and Lake of the Woods. Unless it is spelled out in a consolidation agreement, districts with election districts have no legal way to go back to at-large positions. Cook County, which has five members, chronically cannot get anyone to run in a certain election district, and they would really like to change that, Mr. Chairman, and this bill would help them do that. Also, can I suggest on the amendment, I think the words wholly or partly within a city of the first class, if you think of Minneapolis, there's a lot of pieces that connect on to there. I think you want ones that are wholly within the bounds and not the pieces, because we have a lot of school districts that don't go along county lines and may just have, you know, an acre or two of land in the cities of the first class, and as such would not be allowed to do that. So that what looks like to me it would be St. Louis, no, who else? Okay. No. Well, maybe we don't need that, Mr. Chairman. From the list I have, that doesn't look like it would be an issue. No one is close enough.
And Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out what would be the first-class cities? Duluth, Minneapolis. Which first-class cities?
So,
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, the beginning subdivision 7, section A of that, for the cities of the first class, it would maintain the current system right now. So it would not be a change. So St. Paul, Minneapolis,
I was thinking with
Duluth.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sieber, I was thinking it was the other way around.
Right, I think.
And I get it.
So the first
Senator Sieben.
Subdivision A says that those large school districts, it would maintain the same.
Can keep, Mr. Can, Chairman, Senator, Senator Sieben, can keep their their election districts, whatever they call them.
Right. Senator they're not Sieben. They're not allowed to be able to opt out into an at-large system. As in subdivision B,
everybody else can.
Everybody else can by resolution and then by vote of the people of their school district.
Can Senator Rest.
And with this, would this have any impact on city charters at all? City charters, not school districts.
Mr. Senator Chair, Sieben. I would defer to council.
No.
Yes, council?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, no, it won't.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question I have for Senator Sieben and Ms. Kelleher is in regards to the population of these school districts. Mm-hmm. I know the ones you mentioned are indeed quite small. And do you happen to have the numbers of that population? Either student population or the general population of that area?
Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair, I don't believe I don't have that information. I have the top 25 school districts, and Anoka-Hennepin is on that list, and they have 37,000 students, approximately, and then it goes down to Mankato, but they're not on the list.
They're not on there.
And that goes down to 7,500 pupils. So the other remaining school districts that still have elections, with the exception of Anoka-Hennepin, have fewer than 7,500 pupils.
Who does?
Okay.
But
Senator,
I don't have a list.
7,500 people in those school district, the general population, not students.
No, I'm sorry. They have.
Because I would think that Cook and some of these places would be in the hundreds.
Right. I was.
Senator
they have
Sieben.
Fewer than 7,500 students.
Mr. Chairman, my
Senator
point
Kiffmeyer.
Being made, though, that for the examples you gave, they're exceedingly small, and I can see the very much common sense in regards to that. They are like that. But in the case of Anoka-Hennepin with 37,000, I don't see it.
Right. And, Mr. Chair,
Sieben.
I think that if, and not having spoken to officials from Anoka-Hennepin, but I would think that we may want to consider exempting them. They're not exempt because they're not a city of the first class. But because they're such a large school district, I think it, you know, I don't, my intention was not to allow them to move to this process where they have just that large elections. So perhaps council could advise how to go about excluding Anoka-Hennepin, or perhaps, as we briefly discussed, you know, we could exempt the school districts with a certain number of pupils or something like that.
And does council want to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. There are a number of ways we could do that. I have a list that Senator Sieben mentioned with the top 25 school districts based on size, and if the committee were to pick a threshold, we could easily exempt school districts with a certain pupil size. We just need to know what that number is, or if we want to name them by district, or
Mr. Chairman,
or how we'd like to proceed.
Sure. And Senator Rest, to this point,
yes,
I have others on the list.
Point, I would also be interested in knowing which of the school districts already have at-large elections to see which ones would be affected. For example, Robbinsdale already has at-large elections. We don't have election districts.
South Washington.
I'm not sure about Osseo, but that would be helpful of knowing, even if we put a cutoff on the per pupil or the adjusted average daily membership, how many would actually be affected, because you don't want to forbid a school district that already has at large elections to continue to have at large elections. Correct?
Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I don't think you would be forbidding them from changing. What this legislation would do would exclude those districts that right now have district elections from moving at large.
But not any of the others.
Correct. And so, Madam Chair,
so I'm just curious,
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, in this list, starting with, you know, a school district that has 7,538 kids in it, how many of those school districts above that level would be affected. Ms. Kelleher, do you know?
Yeah.
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rust, I did read the list of folks. As we're doing our quick math over here at the table, Anoka-Hennepin, of course, Elk River would be, and Minneapolis is on the list, too. So that the amendment takes care of Minneapolis. So really the two that are impacted with this discussion of pupil size would be Anoka-Hennepin and Elk River. And Mr. Chairman, I happen to know someone at the table was a former Anoka-Hennepin school board member, and he might be able to shed some light on how Anoka-Hennepin might feel about it.
Thanks a lot.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes, no. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I served 8 years as vice chair of the Anoka-Hennepin School District, and for the record, it is the largest. It's larger than St. Paul, so the numbers here are wrong, so I think we should get that fixed. My wife said, don't try to be funny, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. The reason Anoka, it works in Anoka-Hennepin is because they looked at, there are five high schools plus an alternative high school, that's six, and that graduates about 600 to 700 per high school, and actually every year they graduate 3,000 students. And they looked at, or we looked at clusters. So you represent the community, the high school cluster that you're at, and there's been really no desire, at least in the 8 years I was on, to move to an at-large. We saw what Osseo, the neighboring district, went to at-large, and I know both Senator Limmer and I represent both districts, Osseo and Anoka-Hennepin, but there's just, and you're Osseo too, Senator Rest, yeah, there's no desire in Anoka-Hennepin, at least in my 8 years, to go to an at-large, because what they specifically wanted to get away from is, if you look at the spread of Anoka-Hennepin, in the southern part, you have anywhere between 68 to 86% free and reduced. In the northern part, you got literally nothing. And so if you would start to looking at it as an at-large, who's going to represent the core of Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, and Fridley? And having somebody in that ward, and he's been, a matter of fact, a St. Paul School District employee for many years right now who represents that community well. So there was no desire to go to that. So I think, Senator Sieben, I think your ability to seek out maybe Superintendent Carlson to see if we should do an exemption. And I don't know why we're not a city of first choice. So,
it seems to me that obviously in a larger district like yours that they wouldn't have the same problems they do in the smaller districts as far as recruiting candidates because you have a large pool in each ward of people to choose from. But Senator Sieben?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just in visiting here with Ms. Kelleher, perhaps a good amendment that council could propose the language on would be to exclude the 10th largest school districts from having this option. And so that would encompass then Anoka-Hennepin and Elk River, which right now currently have district elections. And just to be clear, this would not change that at all. You still, in Anoka-Hennepin, would not have the option to switch to an at-large election. The district wouldn't have that option if this, if we move forward with this amendment.
So instead of cities of the first class, it would be then the top 10 or the 10 most populated school districts. So, and Senator Rest, to this point.
Yeah. What happens if the 10th largest loses population and another school district comes in to that? It would seem to me that with that amendment, that there should be a time period, like the top 10 now, and not until after the next census, with the top 10, have it go for a length of time so that school districts from year to year are not falling in or out of the top of the top 10. You just might want to consider that, so you can have a general law, but once they're excluded, they're excluded for at least until the next decennial census, something like that. Then you don't have to keep revising it every year.
And Senator Rest, the next census would be during the regular census, or when is it that they do this yearly, I suppose, for school districts?
No, I'm saying wait until the federal census. So
federal
if they put this into effect, in terms of being excluded, they'd have to wait until the 2020 census to be included or excluded again. Whatever their status is, it would have to be decided for the next 8 years or 7 years or something. Then you don't have to revisit this issue every time a school district, you know, loses population and all of a sudden they're number 11.
Right.
Establish it now and then keep it for a number of years and then reestablish it. And a good time would be after the next census is taken in federal census.
And Senator Sieben or Ms. Kelleher, if you want to respond.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly like that idea. That would give some stability over time. just lost my thought. Mr. Chairman, you have to come back to me. I just forgot it. Okay. Sorry about that.
No problem. And there were a couple others on the list here, too, yet that Senator Newman, did you have a?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll withhold my comments until after we are done with this topic. I have no cities of the first class, and I don't have any school districts in the top 25. So we'll resolve this issue, and then I'll have some comments. Thank you.
And Senator Lemmer.
Regarding this subject, I represent a district with three school districts in the top 10 populations of student body. And the question I had was, as I look at this bill, this is kind of a one-way street bill, meaning you can go from a ward system only to an at-large. You can't go the opposite direction. And what if there were 10% of the number of votes cast that wanted to go the other direction? They wanted wards. They wanted to recognize the unique aspects of neighborhoods or perhaps like in the Osseo District, we have a far different school population on the west side of the district versus the east side of the district. And we've had this discussion off and on. It's never really caught fire well. You may remember Senator Scheid wanted a ward system for Osseo. And yet at the same time, I don't know if the overall population of the entire district wanted to go in that direction. But regardless of that, there are districts that have very diverse student populations. And oftentimes, because of that diversity, some people feel neglected due to the attention of a school district that's trying to run a district, a large district, very economically. And sometimes some of that diversity or the cultural aspects of that school district are oftentimes, or I wouldn't say oftentimes, but occasionally ignored. And so I'm a little concerned that we're creating a policy with a referendum. I enjoy the referendum concept, but it's only going in one direction. And I would think we should have an opportunity to go to a ward system without coming back to the legislature all the time either, and let every district kind of create its own path. I don't necessarily like the times when a school district comes to the legislature simply because now it's like they have to come and get permission from us to run their district or their whatever it is that they're doing and get permission from Big Brother government. And I don't think we need to always be that much of a controller in all of these things. I guess I am disappointed that we didn't have an opportunity for a school district based on their intention to go to a ward system if they chose to. And I'm not sure I haven't had enough time to analyze how this is, if the top 10 school districts are going to be excluded from this policy. I need to chew on this a little bit more to determine what that impact would be in the event that they did have an option to go the opposite direction.
Mr. Chair.
I think that's a good point, Senator Lemmer. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that if a school district wants to go to a ward system,
they can do so right now under current law. So this is not impacting that. So we're not changing that process. If a school district wants to go to an at-large system, they have to have a referendum, but they can do that. So Ms. Kelleher was, and she can articulate this better than I, but it's sort of like right now the system we have we're trying to fix, because you can go in one way and then you're stuck there. You can't get back out. If you're the people want to move to an at-large system, they have no way to move out. They can move into into a ward system that we see there are few school districts in the state that have that, 16 right now. We heard from South St. Paul earlier who wanted to get out. They had no way to get out.
Okay. Did not know that.
And Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm just sensitive to the issue that brought this bill forward, which was about the small, not about the big. And I think if anything has a need here, is more about the small. And I would rather see this legislation go from the perspective of the small, because that's where the need is. But again, here we are having a discussion about the big, and one of them is my school district in my area. And this is not anything they've brought up or anything like that. But I'm just sensitive to the fact that those small, I can understand that. That really makes sense. But, okay, I will defer to whatever other language may come forward. But I just felt it was really important to just mention the whole point here was about the small, not about the big. And here we are focusing on the big.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I agree with you. And that's why we were trying to exclude the large districts so that the small ones are still eligible to move to an at-large system. It's just a question of where you draw the line of what's big versus small that we're trying to work through right now. But I don't feel real strongly about where we draw the line.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is exactly why I was asking the question about the size of those school districts, was to kind of get an idea for that. But I don't have the knowledge or the information to deal with it. I'm sure you as an author and Ms. Kelleher can figure that out.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to acknowledge what Senator Sieben indicated that we did meet earlier today, and I wish to thank Senator Sieben for the A3 amendment. I really do like the idea of putting this issue to the voters. Senator Sieben was receptive to the idea, and I wanted to acknowledge and thank her. Affecting rural schools. I have no large schools.
I think he ran for national party chair.
Did he? What's his name? That's a familiar name.
School goes to at large.
Chairman. National.
In fact, have the legal ability to go back to the ward system. So to that point specifically, I'd like to ask Senate Council. District under this proposal goes to an at-large system and then later decides they want to go back to the ward system. Does that school district or would that school district have that ability to do that?
And Senator
I'm
Newman.
Asking Senate Council, not Ms. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, yes, they would have that ability, but they couldn't have the same vote within a 2-year period. So they couldn't this year change one way and then next year go back and change. There can only be one election on the subject every 2 years.
Any other questions? There's the amendment, and the amendment. I don't know if there's language drawn up that would move to addressing the size of the schools rather than cities of the first class.
Well, Mr. Chair,
would be offered as the amendment to the bill.
Thank
yes,
you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Sieben.
And just to clarify, I think we wanted to include the cities of the first class, but then in addition, draw upon the school size so that we're encompassing.
so that we are including Duluth is a city of the first class, but not on the top list, the top largest school district.
And Rochester, too.
And Rochester.
Rochester's a first class.
Okay. And any other questions before? So we'll just wait for the language. Do you have language?
I think I'm ready.
Okay. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll read this back and welcome any input just to make sure I did cover all of the points discussed by the committee. I'm looking at the A3 amendment on line 1.5. After the letter A, insert in the 10 largest school district based on the adjusted average daily membership or in, and then the new language would continue on, which would say in a school district located within the first class. On line 1.10, after the period, insert, the 10 largest districts shall be determined based on average daily membership on July 1st, 2014, and again each year ending in 1 after the decennial census. On line 1.11, after the letter B, oh, no, I'm sorry. On line 1.11, strike everything after the letter B and insert in all districts not subject to paragraph A, comma.
Okay, any discussion at all to the amendment? Yes, Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify with Ms. Stengel that you weren't deleting all of subdivision B, just the parenthetical B.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, that's correct. I was just deleting the language on line 1.11.
Okay. All right. Got it.
Any discussion to the amendment? Okay. Seeing none. All those in favor of the amendment, the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Amendment prevails. And any further discussion to the bill as amended? Okay. Seeing none. Senator Sieben renews her motion that Senate File 1923, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And next, Senator Rest.
Senator Rest, we have Senate File 585.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 585 is a proposal to have Minnesota join the agreement among states that has been adopted in a number of states to this point to elect the president by national popular vote. The language that is in the bill is the language that is adopted in the other states. And there are five articles, and I'll just briefly indicate what they cover. The first article just says that if you enact this proposal, that you automatically then become a member of the agreement. Article 2, which starts at line 114, requires the member states to this agreement to conduct a statewide popular election for president and vice president, which also is what we do now anyway. But it just restates it. Article 3, which starts on line 1.18, provides for the manner in which presidential electors are selected. And the Article 4, which starts on the second page, indicates when the effective date for the agreement would be in force, and that is not until the current electors number 270 or states that would bring you to a total of 270, which is the number needed to formally elect the President of the United States. There's also within that article a procedure to withdraw from the agreement, and also that if at any point the Electoral College is abolished, that the agreement itself terminates automatically. And then in Article 5, the are definitions that are used throughout the Act. I did ask Ms. Stengel in reviewing the bill to review the definitions that are in Article 5 to make sure that they were in sync with Minnesota's election statutes or that they were clear on their face. And she assured me through a memo that that was the case. To date, there have been 10 states that have enacted this national popular vote agreement that have a total or represent a total of 136 electoral votes. And they are California, Hawaii, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, and the District of Columbia. And, of course, currently, although that would not be the case forever, Minnesota has 10 electoral college votes because we have 8 members of Congress and 2 senators, and the and that will probably that will remain until again the next decennial census, where it will probably become 9 because we anticipate losing a member of the a seat in Congress at that point. So that is the substance of the bill, and there are people I think on your agenda, folks here to testify about the bill and to give you some more detailed background. So, Madam Chair, I have no amendments, and again, this is language that's adopted everywhere that the bill has been passed. So, Madam Chair, I would invite you to have the witnesses come forward.
Dr. John Koza from National Popular Vote.
And as he's coming forward, I believe there are handouts with explanations for a lot more detail of how this would affect the Electoral College and the and how it's been brought about in other states and what the implications of that are in terms of how people have campaigned in states that have little population or big population and what impact adopting this may have in future presidential elections once the required number of states would pass it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
John Koza, K-O-Z-A. I'm chair of National Popular Vote, and I'm the main author of this legislation.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chairman Sieben and Senator Rest. The purpose of this legislation is to have the President of the United States elected by a popular vote of the people in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. And as Senator Rest has mentioned, this legislation is law now in 10 states, including 4 small states, 3 medium-sized states, and 3 large states. It's also passed a total of 33 state legislative chambers in 22 states. Most recently, the Oklahoma Senate, where it passed by a 28-18 bipartisan margin. The bill addresses the shortcomings of the current system of electing the president. The major shortcomings of the current system are state winner-take-all laws. So, for example, in Minnesota, there's a law that says that if Mitt Romney gets 1.3 million votes, as he did in 2012, and the Democratic nominee gets 225,000 more votes, then all 10 of Minnesota's electoral votes will go to the candidate who got the most votes, which in this case would have been President Obama. The consequence of this winner-take-all rule is that when candidates are campaigning for president, they zero in only on the closely divided battleground states. And as the map shows on the both front and back of the handout, that means the presidential campaign ignores most of the states of the United States. 40 of the 50 states are virtually ignored. In fact, President Obama and Romney only campaigned together in 8 states total after they were nominated. One of the other consequences is that the concentration on these closely divided battleground states is quite intense. So, for example, if you look at your neighbor, Wisconsin, which has the same population as Minnesota, they received 18 of the 253 post-convention visits and a corresponding amount of the advertising money in the ground game. Neighboring Iowa received 27 of the 253, over 10% of the national total. And Colorado and Nevada, all of which are smaller than Minnesota, received 23 and 13. Just 4 states, Ohio, Virginia, Florida, and Iowa, received 70% of all the campaign activity in 2012. And that's a degree of concentration which has consequences. One of the consequences is in governance, where a sitting president contemplating his reelection or wanting the election of some successor makes government policy. So there's 7% more grants given to closely divided battleground states, as revealed in this book, which came out just on Friday from the Brookings Institute.
Dr. Koza, did you say 7 or 70?
7% more federal grants in battleground states than non-battleground states. So in this book, Presidential Pork, by Dr. Hudak of the Brookings Institute, it details this. There's twice as many presidentially declared disaster declarations, more Superfund exemptions, more No Child Left Behind waivers, and so forth. The other consequence of the winner-take-all rule is that a second-place candidate can win the White House, and that's happened 4 in 57 elections, about 1 in 14 times. And we've had many near misses. So a shift of 214,000 votes would have elected Mitt Romney in 2012, even though President Obama was 5 million votes ahead, or conversely, a shift of 60,000 votes in 2004 would have elected John Kerry, even though President Bush was substantially ahead. So the purpose of this bill is to make every person's vote equal throughout the United States, and more importantly, make every person's vote in every state be politically relevant in every presidential election. So this bill has a number of supporters listed in our document, including 5 previous presidential candidates, 2 Democrats, Birch Bayh and Howard Dean, and 3 Republicans, Newt Gingrich, Fred Thompson, and Tom Tancredo. So this bill has bipartisan support, and we would appreciate your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Koza. Are there any questions? The next testifier is Patrick Rosensteel. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, as he's coming forward, I would also note that here in Minnesota, the support for the bill is also bipartisan, and I'm joined on in the authorship by Democrats Stumpf and Hayden, and Republicans Housley and Peterson. B.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pat Rosensteel. I'm a senior counselor to National Popular Vote. I have had the pleasure of visiting with legislators all across the country on this issue, and it's my pleasure today to testify before my home state's committee in the Senate. I am a Minnesotan. I wanted to drill down just a little bit on the United States Constitution, because if you do your Google search, you'll see some things pop up like National Popular Vote is an end run on the Constitution. And frankly, as a strict constructionist, I take objection to any sort of, sort of shot like that, because clearly this is a constitutionally conservative bill. It preserves the power of the state to award electors, and it simply asks the legislature, as Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution would have us ask the legislature, whether or not National Popular Vote is in the better interest of the state of Minnesota and the country we love than the current system made up roughly of 48 winner-take-all rules, which drives the current system. Dr. Koza did a great job of describing what the winner-take-all rule is, so I will not, take any time reminding anybody else. But it's important to point out that two states have exercised their plenary power, their exclusive power under Article 2, Section 1, to award electors in a different way than the other 48 states. And those two states are Maine and Nebraska, and they do it by congressional district. And I think it's important to point out that Maine and Nebraska moved to a congressional district system by simply considering a state statute change like you are considering today as members of the Minnesota Senate. And that's because after 30 votes, the founding fathers took 30 votes over 22 days to determine what method they would dictate to the states for awarding electors, and they could not agree. They could not agree on a method. Madison wanted what looked more like direct election of the president. Hamilton wanted what looked like more like a king, okay? And so after 22 days and 30 votes in deliberation, they determined they were going to be moot, and they were going to leave the method for awarding electors in the place that they believed it belonged, which is in the sovereign vote of the legislature, the body of government that was closest to the people. Okay, so the idea that we would require a constitutional amendment to make this change is like saying we need to change the city charter to fill a pothole. Okay, Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution says each state shall appoint, in a manner the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors. That is the language, that is the governing language of how the states participate in the Electoral College. In Article 1, Section 10, states are allowed to form agreements amongst themselves, interstate compacts, which is National Popular Vote. National Popular Vote is an interstate compact, just like the Great Lakes Compact that we are a member of, just like Powerball. The question for the legislature is it in the better interest of Minnesota to join other states to award their electors on the basis of who wins the National Popular Vote? And in doing so, you're acknowledging that the current system is broken, that it's wrong that 4 out of 5 of American voters are left on the political sideline, including voters in the state of Minnesota, which is not a battleground state, but 4 out of 5 American voters live in what are called flyover states, where one candidate's either comfortably ahead or hopelessly behind. And those voters do not get campaigned to. They do not get special treatment from American presidents. And I think that that is a problem that's worth fixing. Now, what I think is pretty irrelevant, right, because y'all are the ones with the election certificates, and you're the ones that the founders ordained with this power to determine how Minnesota is going to participate in the Electoral College. I think it's important for me to underscore to any of my constitutionally conservative friends that NPV, the National Popular Vote Bill, preserves the state power to award electors. It's asking you simply, do you believe that the National Popular Vote is in the better interest of the state of Minnesota and our issues and our interests than the current winner-take-all statute that relegates Minnesota voters to flyover status, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or independents? This is the only election reform bill I've ever been involved in my life that is truly bipartisan and truly nonpartisan in nature. The question to ask yourself is, do you believe that Minnesota has 10 electoral votes to preserve the disproportionate political influence of the voters of the state of Ohio, the state of Virginia, the state of Iowa, and the state of Florida. That is the simple voting question here. Or do you believe that all of the voters in this room and all of the voters of Minnesota outside this room should have an equal voice in electing the President of the United States? And if you agree with the later concept that we, a vote in Minnesota, should matter as much as a vote in the battleground state of Florida, then national popular vote is a very simple I vote to make. And I thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, I do take exception to comparing the Great Lakes Compact to the lottery, but other than that, I appreciate your comments.
They're both compacts.
Senator Ress and Mr. Rosenstiel, too, I would point out that I heard that you're a Minnesotan, but we have had a history of passing good bipartisan election legislation here in Minnesota, too. So this can be among other bipartisan pieces of election legislation, perhaps.
Madam Chair, thank you. And it's the only one I've been involved in.
Okay.
Thank
you. Nice.
Questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, or maybe someone from your table could answer this question. We keep hearing this argument that if we go with a national popular vote, accounting of our voters' intentions, we no longer will be a flyover state. Now, quite honestly, I look at elections as more of a marketing exercise than anything else, and I would tend to think that the marketing concentrations are going to be in the highly populated states anyway, whether they have electoral votes up for grabs or not. And quite honestly, I think the Midwest is going to be a flyover region no matter what we do. So what are we really gaining, if that's true, if my assertion is correct, what are we really gaining by moving the country to this form of headcounting?
Well, we know how presidential... Chair Sieben, and in response to Senator Limmer's question, Limmer. We know how presidential candidates campaign when they're faced with every vote being equal and the candidate with the most votes wins the election. And if I'd call your attention to the handout, we have maps that show how they actually campaign in 2012, similar to previous years. I'll call your attention to the Iowa map, which is right on top. One might think that presidential candidates somehow congregate around big cities or maybe ignore rural areas. But in fact, if you look at the map, each of the dots represents a campaign visit and a corresponding amount of ground effort and money. And you'll see that they campaigned all over Iowa, not just in Des Moines and Council Bluffs and Davenport. They campaigned just about equally in each of the four congressional districts. Now, if you flip to Ohio, which consumed 73 of the 253 visits, in other words, here's this one state that received far more attention than any other, you will also see that they weren't sitting in Toledo and Cleveland and Columbus. They were campaigning all over the state. And the reason is, inside the state of Ohio, under the current system, every vote is equal, and the candidate with the most votes wins. So whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you're going to go virtually everywhere in the state. You're certainly going to have a ground game. You're going to advertise on TV. You're going to make visits pretty much in proportion to where the people are. So I don't think it's correct, based on actual evidence of what real presidential candidates do now, to say that any state is going to be ignored. Another example is, if you look back at the big map on the back of the one-pager, you'll notice New Hampshire got 14 visits, whereas the other 12 small states, the 3 and 4 electoral votes, states got none. Now, if every vote was equal and candidate with the most votes would win. If you took those 13 smallest states together, why would a candidate only go to the state of New Hampshire and ignore Hawaii, Alaska, Idaho, Montana, North and South Dakota, Vermont, Maine, Rhode Island, District of Columbia, and whoever I forgot? They would, in fact, campaign, take those 12 visits and the corresponding amount of money and spread them out over the 12 states. So I think we have evidence from the real world of how they campaign.
There's a lot of formulas that go into political campaign strategy, and trying to get the best bang for your political campaign dollar also has a lot to do with this. You go into big markets because if you have to buy so many TV commercials in a big market, you get a bigger concentration of vote versus buying the same amount of time, let's say, in South Dakota or Wyoming. It's just not to scale that you need in order to gain the most vote and influence election. I still think that you're not going to have, if we pass this, that you're automatically going to have presidential candidates flying into Bismarck. I just don't see it happening, even though that individual vote may have the same weight as a vote in New York City. You can get the bigger bang for your buck by concentrating your effort and the most vote that you want to see on the election day in these big markets. I just don't see everyone going to be concentrating as much influence in these flyover states that we know of now. They're still going to be flyover states regardless of what we do. And on the other hand, when we make mention of these type of examples of the three or four states, there's other strategies there too. There's other strategies. You know, these are primary states. These are states that have primaries early, and there's a compounding effect to make sure that your party has some presence in those states, even for the next election down the road. It's important to build that organization, and you do it by concentrating your influence in these states, not only for the individual candidate, but for future projects down the road. So I don't buy the argument that the flyover states of today are going to be the concentrated headquarters of campaign organizations in the future if we go this route.
Mr. Rosenstiel.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I would just urge you to consider that media markets are based on a cost per point, and it's more affordable to reach voters in rural media markets. And I think the problem we're trying to solve is the idea that 4 out of 5 American voters live in flyover states and are wholesalely ignored in the post-convention period when presidents are campaigning for their votes. And so to understand that of the $978 million, almost $1 billion that was spent running for president in 2012, all of that was spent in just 12 states. Right, which means 38 states were wholly excluded from the process. And so while I agree with you, there are campaign strategies that both sides of the aisle will use in order to elect their candidates. The truth is when we run for a statewide race for governor, for example, in Minnesota, neither the Republican candidate or the Democratic candidate ignores the smallest portions of Minnesota, right? Republicans are trying to drive their margin in what's the L, right, and carve into Democratic margins in the Iron Range. And Democrats have their strategies. But there isn't a single voter in Minnesota, for example, that's paying $12 for a Pawlenty or Dayton lawn sign. And in presidential campaigns, if you live in a flyover state, you have to pay for your lawn sign so the money can get exported to battleground states to build stronger state parties on both sides of the aisle. And so that has real impacts, not just on the body politic and the campaign, but on policy outcomes that are driven by administrations. Now, when George Bush was running for re-election, right, 2 years before his re-election campaign, he was polling in just 18 states. Okay, that means 32 states were not being polled by the commander-in-chief to figure out what issues are important to them. We were moving policies like Part D, the prescription drug bill, $978 billion entitlement program, to keep the promises we made to the voters of the I-4 corridor of Florida. Okay? And it was because it was Florida. Now, reasonable people can be on both sides of that issue, but there is perverse political power in the battleground states that is legitimate from a policy standpoint. And I think on the politics side of things, no voter would be ignored, because you don't ignore a single voter in your district, right? And this is turning it into a first-past-the-post, winner-take-all campaign across the United States.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rosenstiel, one of the shortcomings that's been described today is Minnesota is currently a winner-take-all. So I got two questions, pretty straightforward. Wouldn't, if Minnesota were to adopt a statute which allowed the electors to be distributed according to congressional districts, would that not, at least in some degree, moderate the winner-take-all aspect? Second question, from a purely historical standpoint, are there any other examples that you can give to us as to how the electors have been selected and distributed other than the current winner-take-all or by congressional district?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Newman, thanks for the question. Second question first. There have been many different methods that states have used to award electors. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts has had 11 different methods that they've used to award electors. Some have been governors appointing a slate of electors. Sometime the legislature has elected a slate of electors. There used to be what was called presidential elector districts, and a lot of the first states used it. Interestingly enough, of the 13 original states, only three of them used what looked kind of like our winner-take-all statute today. So many different states have had many different methods. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts has had 11 different methods. As for a congressional district system, if what you're trying to do is make every voter in every state relevant, and I'm not going to say equally relevant to a previous point, but if you're interested in making every voter in every state politically relevant in every presidential election, a congressional district system takes a bad system and makes it worse. And here's why I say that. Because on a regular basis, in a presidential year, there may be 40 to 50 competitive congressional districts in a presidential campaign. In Minnesota, the most competitive is the first congressional district. And that might be a battleground congressional district under a congressional district system, but the other seven are either reliably red or Republican or reliably blue, and all of them would be wholly ignored in a congressional district system. Because campaigns campaign in and presidents govern to competitive states, and under a congressional district system, they do it to competitive congressional districts. And while the current system leads to bad policy, you know, under a congressional district system, everybody might want to know what the Mayo Clinic wants. And I love the Mayo Clinic. I think it's a great asset in the state of Minnesota. But when we're electing the president of the United States, kind of makes sense to have a system where every voter in every state is relevant, because it doesn't pervert public policy in a way where we get transactional with battleground state voters.
Senator Newman.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just follow-up comment. Mr. Rosenstiel, I'm not sure that I agree with you in terms of the issue of congressional districts. I can think of several in Minnesota that are, in fact, competitive. One would be the first, the seventh. A few years ago, the eighth, which was reliably in DFL hands, there was, for lack of a better term, an upset. Jim Oberstar was removed from office. So my point is that maybe if we had something other than winner-take-all, where congressional districts might just moderate that system, you might also get some presidential campaigns coming in because they want to ensure the seventh or the first. So I'm not so sure that it's as clear-cut as what you maybe have alluded to. And that doesn't mean that I'm sold on the congressional district. it just, for me, is kind of an interesting topic of discussion. But I thank you for your comments.
Mr. Rosenstiel, did you want to reply?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, I just wanted to follow up that I agree that there are competitive congressional districts in Minnesota, but at the presidential campaign level, I mean, the 8th district changed hands, but the 8th district was a reliable congressional district for President Obama, and the 7th congressional district was a reliable congressional district for Mitt Romney. And while I just want to clarify that I agree that our congressional districts can be competitive at the congressional level, in the presidential campaign, which is our single subject here, they're either reliably red or reliably blue. The other one that can be battleground occasionally is the 3rd congressional district. And I agree that a congressional district system is an interesting conversation and that it underscores sort of the fact that it is the purview of the legislature. It is the plenary power of the legislature to determine how they're going to award electors. And while there's nothing unconstitutional about a congressional district system, I think it does not concentrate more activity other than outside the first. So,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the concept of a popular vote is always a popular idea, right? But in Minnesota's elections, or in elections historically, generally speaking, the electoral vote has fairly well followed the popular vote, correct? So I would say that contrary to what we say here, that it's so broken, I don't agree. And I think that tends to feed into a cynical concept towards our elections I don't think is really deserved. I'm not sure that interstate commerce can be applied to elections. I have to research that a little bit more, but I don't think, unless you talk about buying votes, I don't think, you know, interstate commerce is generally a consumer-minded kind of an approach. I'm not sure that that really applies here. And, you know, when I hear the focus of elections pretty generally go to competitiveness and also to population. Popular vote is going to be competitiveness and it's going to be population. So I don't know that you get much of a, that may be a change without a distinction. And I just am concerned also that our small, two very small states, New Hampshire and Iowa, serve us quite well, the Northeast and the Midwest. We get a lot of trade-off from that as far as people paying attention to us. I know California has complained that you spend all this money in Iowa and New Hampshire, nobody comes out west. Every election system in regards to this kind of campaigning has some of these dynamics going on, and I don't know if we can just single one out. But those are just my comments, and but I'm just making those, Madam Chair. I don't necessarily need an answer, but I would say probably one of the biggest ones, having gone through the Bush v. Gore recount, where we had a nationwide huge thing going to the courts, but that was relegated to one state's recount. Now multiply that by about 30 states or so when you have a national popular vote, because that's what will happen. And so I just have some kind of like the practical concerns of not just the casting of the vote, but you're really not done with an election until you've gone through all of those things. And right now on the Electoral College, at least you have more of a state-by-state. If you have some of those issues, they are relegated to that. So I see that as kind of a benefit. But I have not totally researched, but I still have some very serious concerns, and I'm not convinced that the system is broken. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other discussion? We do have some other members of the audience who want to testify in this. If Mr. William Christoffel could come forward. Also, and then next will be Terry Hokanson and then Virginia Redgrave. Mr. Christoffel, welcome to the committee. Please
Thank you.
State
Thank
your
you.
Name.
It's good to be here. I'm surprised to be here.
You need to state your name first.
Oh, my name's William Christoffel. And it's good to be here, but I'm surprised to be here. I signed an online petition in support of the national popular vote. And this Friday, I received an email asking me to come and testify. I was totally unprepared, but I said yes, because I do support it. I have no political affiliation or agenda, and I support the popular vote because I basically think the current system is broken. I think that the national popular vote can help in several ways, both in reality and by perception. The main reason that I'm in favor of a national popular vote is because it will eliminate the problem of a candidate winning the election who has the fewest number of popular votes. That is the reality part of it. And one problem with that, this is not so much a problem, I think, with the Minnesota. This has to do with national perception. If the candidate who wins the least number of votes gets the office of president, I think it undermines the legitimacy of the candidate, and I think it undermines the legitimacy of the process. I think that these days the trust of the average person in the institutions of government is at a very low level. And when an American sees that the candidate with the most votes does not get to be president of the United States, I think that contributes to their lack of trust in the government, their lack of belief that the will of the people is what is determining the course of events in the government. And having a national popular vote will remove a level of obscurity between the will of the people and the execution of the will of the people, and I think it will help to restore trust in the government. And I think that perception, I'm not talking about the point of the reality of eliminating the possibility of a candidate winning with the fewest votes. I'm talking about the perception of the American people that their will is what will be acted on, and that a priori, when they go to vote, that they trust that their vote and their will be will have an influence. And then I think that's mostly what I have to say. There are other reasons too. I think the current system disenfranchised a lot of voters, and the national popular vote could in many ways re-enfranchise them, but I think I've spoken enough. That's my main point.
Thank you very much for coming today, sir. Mr. or Ms., sorry, I'm not sure, Terry Hokanson? Not here. How about Virginia Redgrave?
And passing.
Pardon? I see. Ms. Redgrave.
Never mind.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jenny Redgrave. Can you hear me? Okay. I want to thank you for giving me a chance to speak briefly. I'm here as a citizen just to request that you will hopefully see your way to support this bill. It's my concerted belief that every citizen's vote should be counted equally, valued equally under the system. And I just would note that this bill has been endorsed by over 2,000 legislators nationally to date. And it also has a bipartisan composition on the advisory board. So to me, that's a meaningful statistic. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Ms. Redgrave. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this legislation?
Sir, please come to the table and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Bob Auden. I'm here to represent the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. I know I don't think the president should be, you know, elected like they do on you know, these TV shows. We have the electoral vote because a lot of people don't get to know the president, and unfortunately, our media doesn't really tell us about the candidates. We hear a horse race, but we don't really get to know them. Having this buffer that would particularly protect smaller states, I think is a good thing to have the Electoral College. I guess, you know, when we're talking about everybody's vote counts, I can tell you that a Libertarian vote does not count. You never see it in election time. It used to be way back 30, 40 years ago, you could see the Libertarian vote totals as they were being added up. But you don't see those anymore. But under this system, I was just curious, if we had 10% of the vote, would we get an electoral?
Mr. Chair, is that it? I'm sorry, sir. Mr. Ott, is it?
Mr. Auden, yes.
If that's a question, you can address that to Senator Rest, but I believe the answer is no, that the all of the state's electoral college votes would go to the popular vote winner.
See, and I, you know, they keep talking about, you know, people's vote count, and I guess I don't see any difference with this system than the current system, so I see no reason to change.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Ott.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else in the audience who cares to testify? With that, Senator Rest moves
I
that.
I would move to that Senate file, whatever it is.
585
be recommended
585.
To pass. 585 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes and the bill is referred
Thank
to rules.
Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rest. With that, the committee is adjourned. Yeah. Thank you, members.
Couldn't agree. Yeah. So there was no original intent. So there were many original intents.
I always thought that there had been multiple quite interesting ways for the various states.
Thank you.
I just don't
I'll type it up and send it to you. So my notes are kind of.
Yeah. Everybody's coming on to this.
I'll send it to you right now. Thank you.
To what?
The winner short term things like that. Electoral votes.
Different parts of
that I have.